The United States has been an unconditional supporter of Israel. It doesn't make any difference to us anymore who is in office in the United States, who is the ambassador in Israel, who is the ambassador in Jordan or Saudi Arabia. To us, the United States is going to be on the side of Israel. They are not honest brokers when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to the Palestinian conflict.
That's Rami Barhoush, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Rami Barhoush on Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and the United States. Jordan's borders were drawn by British imperial cartographers after World War I. It was then called Transjordan and sparsely populated. Today, it has a large Palestinian population, many of them refugees from the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, and the 1967 war. In recent years, it has also seen a huge influx of refugees from Iraq and Syria. Jordan is ruled by a hereditary Hashemite king who has absolute power. There are internal tensions in the country that so far have been kept under control. The Palestinians lack political power but dominate the economy. The kingdom's alliance with the United States makes some Jordanians very uncomfortable. Jordan's neighbor Israel, the highest recipient of U.S. aid, continues to build more settlements on Palestinian land in defiance of international law, while Washington approves. The Middle East and U.S. involvement in that region continues to be a major source of global instability. Our guest today is Rami Barhoush. He's an activist and president of the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, known as APN. It's based in Amman, Jordan. I talked with him in Amman. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
What is APN? What is its work?
The Arab Group for the Protection of Nature is a Jordanian organization that was set up in 2003. This was around the first couple of years of the Palestinian Intifada, which is the uprising of the Palestinians against Israel's occupation. We saw how the Israeli occupation forces were systematically working at destroying the livelihood of the Palestinians on their own land. And for the Palestinians, trees are the sustenance that they live off, olive trees, fig trees, citrus, and so on. And their connection to the land. Most of these trees were planted by their ancestors. We have some trees a couple of thousand years old. The oldest olive tree in the world is in Beit Lahem. It's about 5,000 years old. So the trees are as old as the Palestinians in Palestine. So they don't only consider the trees their sustenance and their livelihood, but they also consider them their connection to the land. The Israelis were systematically uprooting them, area by area, under pretexts of security, of passing roads, of enlarging settlements, you know, so many different excuses so that they can cut the trees and leave the Palestinians without any alternatives. This way they would weaken the Palestinian communities in Palestine. This way they can make it easier for their occupation to last. So we decided to set up an organization in Jordan to try to raise some funds so that we can help the Palestinian organizations, the agricultural organizations in Palestine, to try to plant some of the trees instead of the ones that were uprooted by the Israelis.
And how do you do that? How do you get the seeds to those areas? Do you recruit volunteers?
Our job here in Jordan is basically getting the funds from local companies, local donors, maybe some Arab companies and donors as well, to try to get the funds into Palestine and direct it towards the co-ops, the agricultural unions, the agricultural organizations inside Palestine. They take this money to go and contract nurseries that provide the plants, and they go and get their volunteers and get, with the help of these villages that are going to benefit from these funds, they go and they replant the trees.
How easy is it, or how difficult is it, to go back and forth overland from Jordan into the Israeli-occupied territories?
Palestinians are not, or Jordanians, were not allowed to go back to Palestine until Jordan signed the peace treaty with Israel in 1994. After that, Israelis were allowed to come into Jordan without visas, whereas Jordanians were only allowed to enter Israel after obtaining the visas. And the visas usually are very hard to obtain. Most of the cases get refused. And when they do, they only do this after a lot of scrutiny. So getting into Palestine is a really big problem for most of us.
And for people under occupation and the stresses and difficulties that occupation entails, what kind of consciousness or awareness is there about environmental issues?
First of all, the Palestinians have always been agricultural communities. They are a people that sustain themselves based on their agriculture. So their connection to the land is very strong. They feel the soil, they feel the water, they feel the trees. After the occupation, after the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the Palestinians were even limited more to agriculture because they were not able to do any trading. You know, the borders were sealed off of them. They couldn't import, they couldn't export, they couldn't start industries. Because they couldn't get any machines inside, they couldn't, you know, get permits for things like that. So the Palestinians were really restricted to agriculture. And, you know, when you're an agricultural person, when you're a peasant, when you're a farmer, you are an environmentalist by default, because environment is your life. The water, you know, you harvest the water, you take care of the soil, you take care of the trees, you know, you don't want pollution to ruin your land and so on. So the Palestinians are, I would say, environmentalists by nature.
Boulder, Colorado, where I live and work, has a sister city project with Nablus inside of Palestine. How important is that kind of solidarity to, in terms of overcoming the difficulties that people face in their day-to-day lives?
You know, when you are in dire situation like the Palestinians, I'm going to quote something that I've read a while ago, an interview with Nelson Mandela. And the person that was interviewing him asked him, what were the main reasons for the success of the South African revolution against, or the South African, revolution against the whites, the apartheid system? And he gave two main reasons. The first one was that they stuck to their strategies and kept changing the tactics, but they never changed their strategies. They never compromised on their principles. The second one was that the international community's support was so important for them, it kept giving them life. No matter what happened on the ground, if they knew that people outside of South Africa were following it up, were supporting them even morally, it gave them fuel. It gave them power. They knew they were getting closer to their goal. I say Palestinians need the support, not only monetary support. They need to know that people appreciate that they are resisting occupation. People like activists, people with morals, people with principles are looking at them and saying, "These, you know, the Palestinians need to get a solution, need to find a way out of the occupation." And it is very important for us that people in the United States, people in Europe, look at the Palestinians and do something. Because for us, the Europeans and the Americans come from prosperous communities, from prosperous countries. They have means. They come from countries where there's participation in decision-making, democratic governments. If they understand the situation of the Palestinians, they may be able to influence their decision-makers, the people they elect, to try to do something in alleviating their hardship.
2017 marks a couple of anniversaries that have had a big impact on the situation in the Middle East, West Asia. It's the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and it's the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, 50th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, annexation of East Jerusalem and annexation of the Golan Heights. Let's start with the Balfour Declaration, and why was it important?
The Balfour Declaration, I think, is one of the big crimes of the 20th century. Somebody promises something that he doesn't own, that he has no right to somebody else that has no right to it. So the British promised the Jews a national home over the land of Palestine. So the Palestinians were the victims of this agreement. And there are so many books that came out, so many reasons why people think that Balfour gave that promise to the Jewish community, to a Jewish lord in England. But at the end of the day, we think it was unfair. We still think that United Kingdom should apologize for this criminal declaration. And this was the beginning of our problem, of our catastrophe. When the Ottoman Empire that ruled most of the areas that are now the Arab world, part of which was Palestine, the Ottomans were defeated in the First World War, and the British and the French took mandate over these areas. The British decided that Palestine should go as a national home for the Jewish people. Palestinians had communities, they had livelihood, they had ports, they had farms, you know, they had schools and colleges. All of this meant nothing to the British when they gave Palestine as a national home for the Jews. No consideration was given to them because of so many other formulas that were benefiting the British at the time that didn't have anything to do with the Palestinians.
And when the declaration was made by Balfour in 1917, approximately how many Jews were in Palestine? What percentage?
Palestine had always consisted, I think, somewhere between 4 and 3% Jews, 6 to 10% Christians, and the rest were Muslims. But all were Palestinians. The Palestinian Jews lived with the Palestinian Muslims and the Palestinian Christians as one people. There was never any difference between them. They worked together, they went to schools together, they lived in the same villages and towns. The problem that started everything was the idea of Zionism. It was a European colonial idea. European Jews wanted to create a national homeland for the Jewish people. They decided it should be Palestine, and they started working on transforming a religion into a race, into an ethnic race. And for this ethnic race to be accepted, it had to have a homeland, and they decided that Palestine should be the homeland. Now, for them to make it a Jewish homeland, they needed to become majority. And for them to become majority, they needed to kick out the existing majority. And this is the big crime that they committed against the Palestinians. For them to set up their state, they had to kick out the original people, the indigenous people, the rightful owners of Palestine. They had to kick them out. Otherwise, they would not be a majority and they would not form their Jewish state. So for them to justify their end, they had to occupy Palestine. By the year 1948, they had destroyed over 560 Palestinian towns and villages. They had over 1 million Palestinians as refugees outside of their towns and cities, and they had killed so many others and set up their state on the ruins of the Palestinian nation.
So let's say concede everything you say is accurate. Isn't it time for bygones to be bygones? And some Israelis and their supporters say, well, you know, there are more than 20 Arab states. Jordan has a huge Palestinian population. Why don't they go there?
It is hard for me to even consider answering such questions. I know they've come up many times. It's like saying, the Jews are very powerful in New York. They are respected. They are maybe the most powerful community in New York. The mayor is usually Jewish. Why don't all the Jews go to New York? The United States loves them. They support them. They feel at home there. Why don't they make New York their state? It doesn't work this way. The Palestinians belong to Palestine. They are the rightful owners. They have been in Palestine forever. If you read the history of this area, you know it has always been inhabited. One of the oldest cities in the world is the city of Jericho. The Palestinians belong in Palestine. it doesn't matter if the Palestinians can go to any other place. This doesn't have anything to do with the conflict. For us to say bygones are bygones, first of all, you need to solve the problems. The establishment of the State of Israel left so many Palestinian refugees outside of Palestine, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan, living in refugee camps, and still some, most of which still are considered not citizens of these countries. Now, these people deserve to go back. This is not only the rightful place to go back, it is also international law. Resolutions in the United Nations gave the Palestinians the right to go back. Bygones can be bygones when these Palestinian refugees get the right to return. And let me just say something. If you are a Jew who has never even been outside of, let's say, the United States or Poland or Russia, and you decide to go to Israel, the minute you land in the airport, you become an Israeli citizen. There's a law in Israel called the Aliyah Law, the law of return for Jews. Any Jew anywhere in the world can just land in Israel and immediately become a citizen, whereas the millions of Palestinians and their descendants who were kicked out of their lands can never go back, cannot even go for visits, and are not even considered in the negotiations that the Israelis are talking with the Palestinians.
And psychologically, if you could generalize, what does this do to the psyche of a people that have been dispossessed and denied?
The Palestinians have so many memories of Palestine, and even though the Palestinians have been, 55% of the Palestinians are outside of Palestine. They try to form their own communities, they try to keep their traditions, but at the end of the day, this is not only a Palestinian issue, it has become a world issue. You know, so many people around the world are sympathizing with the Palestinian cause because it is the longest standing occupation in history or in modern history. The Palestinians, you know, issues have not been addressed. So many resolutions around, you know, in the United Nations were made to try to enforce the rights of the Palestinians. About 70 or maybe more than 70 of these resolutions were vetoed by the United States alone. The fact that Israel gets this unconditional support from the world superpower, the Palestinians are helpless. You know, and there is consensus around the world that the Palestinians have rights and need to go back to their homes. Look at the resolutions discussing the end of the occupation of Palestine in the General Assembly. Usually, the whole world votes that the Palestinians should go back to their lands, the occupation should end, Israel should go back to the borders before the conflict of 1967. And you know how many countries vote against it? The United States and maybe three or four or six or seven other countries. Countries, you know, with all due respect, that do this because the United States asked them to. Countries like Nauru or Tuvo or Micronesia, you know. So the rest of the world is in agreement. In, I think, around 2003 or 2004, there was discussion in the Criminal Court of Justice as to the legality of the separation wall that Israel was building around the Palestinian side in the West Bank. This lawsuit went so many lengths in understanding the issue. First of all, the 15 judges of the Criminal Court of Justice that belonged to the United Nations looked at the occupation. All 15 of them said that the occupation was illegal. The occupation of Palestine was illegal. And one of these judges was American. And not only American, he was an American Jew. The judge from Britain was a British Jew. And all of them voted unanimously that the occupation was illegal. Now, when they came to the wall, they voted against the wall, against the building of the separation wall that the Israelis were building around the Palestinians, 14 to 1. 14 judges voted that the wall is illegal. The judge from the United States said it might be illegal in most of the areas, but we have to address that the terrorism and the problems that the Israelis are getting on some parts where the wall was being built, and maybe that should be justified. But see, there is consensus around the world. The Palestinian case is very clear. There is military occupation. It has been longstanding. You know, occupation is oppressive. It's violent. You know, it destroys nations. It should end.
And that wall that you mentioned, apparently 10% more of Palestinian land was annexed as a result of that wall. And sometimes farmers who are on that side of the wall cannot get to their land, which is now on the other side of the wall.
Let's go back a little bit to the, you know, to the past. In 1947, the United Nations passed a resolution partitioning Palestine. This partition plan gave the Palestinians 45% of the land, and it gave the Jewish immigrants from Poland and Russia and, you know, and different European countries, gave them 55%. Now, the Palestinians did not accept the partition plan, and there was war. The war of 1948, when the British mandate ended in Palestine, the outcome of 1948's war was that the Israelis controlled 78% of the land of Palestine and left 22% to the Palestinians. This 22% is what you now know as the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, throughout the years, the Israelis kept breaking international law, using occupied land for their own benefit and building illegal settlements all over the West Bank. You have so many settlements in the West Bank, dissecting the West Bank into Bantustans and small areas, small pockets for the Palestinians. And these settlements, you know, needed roads, needed highways, needed service stations, sewage, and so on. So the Palestinians were left with about 10% of Palestine, of the land of historical Palestine. Then came the wall. The wall, you know, went around the areas that are the West Bank, but, you know, gave route for the Israeli settlement roads, for the settlements, and so on, and took some more of the Palestinian land and left the Palestinians with about 8% of the land of Palestine. And this 8% is really in question now because, you know, it is being controlled in every aspect. No borders, the Palestinians have no borders, it's controlled by the Israelis. No airports. The air, you know, the space is it's controlled by the Israelis. No ports because all the sea is controlled by the Israelis. So even this 8%, it's a place that is impossible to live in. And this is what the Israelis have been working on. Slowly but surely, they're trying to make the Palestinians' survival on their land impossible, so that they could succumb to them, leave, or end up working as, you know, just cheap labor for the Israelis.
Talk about the importance also of water, which is so critical in a water-stressed area of the world.
You know, the Palestinians were left with the, like I said, the 8% of historical Palestine, parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And these areas have less water than the rest of Palestine. Now, in the West Bank, if you look at the West Bank alone, the West Bank has the water capacity of about 600 million cubic meters a year due to rainfall and some little rivers here and there. Out of the 600 million cubic meters, the Israeli settlements are consuming 580 million, and the Palestinians are left with about 20 million cubic meters. The Palestinians are suffering from the affluent sewage from the Jewish and the Israeli settlements and, you know, near their villages in the West Bank. They are suffering from the use of pesticides, from the use of chemicals, from the factories that they build around. And all of this effluent material is being thrown into Palestinian villages, Palestinian valleys, destroying their agriculture and plantations. And there was recently a very good report on pesticide use in the West Bank by the Pan-Asian Pesticide Network. And it went into Palestinian areas and spoke to farmers and to Palestinians and what have you and to the Palestine Authority. And they found out, and they went and visited the sites where the Israeli settlements were, you know, dumping all their toxic waste and all their chemicals into Palestinian villages. And this is something very sad. The average Palestinian uses some fraction of what the Israeli citizen uses in terms of water per year. The Israeli per capita usage of water, I think, is around 160 cubic meters, whereas the Palestinian is something around 50 or something like that.
And what is the situation of the Palestinians who remained in what became the State of Israel inside the Green Line?
These Palestinians who never left in 1948 remained there and got citizenship, but they are not nationals. You see, there's something important about the State of Israel, is that there's a big difference between a national and a citizen. And it's on your identity card. What is your nationality? It says Arab, Jew, or maybe Druze. If you're an Arab, you don't have many of the benefits that the Jew has in the State of Israel. And this goes back to 3 years after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1951, when the Israeli Knesset signed something called the Basic Law. Basically, what set up the State of Israel were the Jewish Agency, the Jewish Land Fund, the Jewish World Congress, and they set up they were instrumental in establishing the State of Israel. And once the state was set, they needed to arrange the relationship between them and the newly established state. So most of the funding, or maybe all of the funding that comes from the Jewish organizations around the world, goes to these organizations and not to the state, and they give the funding to the Jewish citizens of Israel and not to the Arab citizens. So the Arab citizen is second class. They don't get many of the benefits of being a citizen of Israel. All you need to do is just go there and go to an Arab village and then go to a Jewish city and see the difference. The Arab city is destroyed completely. All the trade and all the commerce has been transferred into the Jewish cities, and the Arabs were left in small villages with very backward schools, no funding, and it is completely obvious to anyone who goes there what a difference is between the two.
And what about the various Christian minorities, the Armenian Orthodox and Protestants, Greek Catholics, Roman Catholics, Greek Orthodox?
You know, Palestine was made up of, different ethnic groups. Majority were Muslim Palestinians, but they also had some Armenian Palestinians, Greek Palestinians, Jewish Palestinians, some Moroccans that had immigrated to Palestine hundreds of years ago and considered themselves Moroccan origin, but Palestinians. All of these consider themselves Palestinians up to this day. They feel that, they are one with all the Palestinian suffering. They feel that they have been deprived of their nationhood. They're deprived of their homes. They can't go back to their country. And there is really no difference between any of them.
What would you consider a just and honorable solution to the conflict?
I think that a one democratic state on the whole land of Palestine will be the only possible solution. I mean, for so many years, we were being told that the two-state solution was the answer. There was general acceptance to this as an only possible solution, whereas the West Bank and the Gaza Strip would become the state of Palestine and the rest of the land would become, would be the state of Israel. But since 1967, since the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by Israel, every Israeli government, one after the other, regardless if they were Labor or Likud, conservative or liberals, they were building settlements on Palestinian lands. They were expanding their roads, expanding industrial areas, stealing the land, destroying trees, continuously and systematically destroying Palestinian survival. Now you're left with, the Palestinians are left with nothing. If you want to say, let's have a two-state solution, the Palestinians cannot have a state of their own because their communities are separated. They live in Bantustans. They're separated from one another by Jewish settlements, by Jewish-only roads, by Jewish, sewage systems, by Jewish industrial areas. So the Palestinians are just, divided pockets here and there. There is no way they can form a state. So now if we look back and we look at the map of Palestine with these little dots here and there that will form the Palestinian communities still in existence in Palestine, the only solution would be just a one democratic state, secular, not Jewish, not Muslim, just like every other state in the world. And let me tell you something. Right now, Israel is the only state in the world that is not the state of its citizens. Like I told you, it is not the state of its citizens, but the state of the Jewish people. If you are a Jew, you can go to Palestine or you can go to Israel and become an Israeli citizen immediately, whereas any other country, you cannot do that. If a Muslim wants to go to Saudi Arabia, this Muslim, let's say a Pakistani, needs to go to Saudi Arabia, this person needs to apply for a visa. He may be accepted or not, and if the visa is approved, he can only go there for a short period of time or for work or something, but never become a citizen. The only place that this happens is Israel, and this is not normal. Palestinians have no rights. They need to be in their land. The refugees and their descendants need to go back to their land, and there is plenty of land for all. All of the citizens of Israel will remain in the same country, and it will become a secular country just like any other country in the world.
You're listening to Rami Barhoush on Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and the United States. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
I've been seeing change on the Israeli side. There are so many Jewish Americans and Jewish Canadians and Jewish Europeans who look at the state of Israel and see signs of fascism, apartheid, signs of racism. They don't accept these things because these are values that they were not raised with in their countries. These are values that are looked down at, you know, in Europe, in the United States, in Australia, and so on. More and more European, American Jews are looking at Israel and think to themselves, I don't align myself with this ideology. And we are seeing people that are coming out and talking, you know, intellectuals like Ilan Pappé, Israeli generals like Miko Peled, and so on, coming to the forefront of the discussion and saying loudly that this is wrong, what you're doing to the Palestinians is unacceptable, the Palestinians have nowhere to go, they are not going anywhere, you have to give them back their rights, they have to live just like everybody else in their own country with respect and dignity.
Now, you've spent a lot of time in the United States, you were educated there, you traveled there. What is your understanding in terms of why U.S. people tend to have a very distorted view of the realities in this part of the world?
Generally, it's more than one reason. One of the reasons why the average American citizen would look at the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and think that Israel is the victim is because the media in the United States has been, you know, influenced by the strong Jewish lobby in America. You have organizations like AIPAC and Anti-Defamation League and so on that are really influential in decision making. You know, they have very close contact with the Congress, with different media, and, you know, they're strong lobbyists. So that's one thing. The other thing is that for a while, maybe for the past 50 years, oil, the Gulf oil, that Saudi Arabian oil and so on, has been very, very important for the American economy. Jimmy Carter said that the Gulf oil is a matter of national security for the Americans. And the Gulf oil needed to be protected by a proxy, somebody close, a country that is going to protect it on behalf of the Americans. And Israel was doing that for them. So there are interests involved. American governments felt that Israel was the non-Arab country in the region that was able to do their job in protecting the oil for American interests and so on. But, you know, at the end of the day, the Arabs are to blame too. The Arabs or the Palestinians have no voice in the United States. They haven't done enough to talk to Americans, to show them what, you know, has been done to them, and to connect, you know, their problems with the problems of other movements and other, you know, nationalities in the world that went through something like that.
And is it your sense that the ringing declarations that come from Arab capitals about Palestinian independence and Palestinian rights is just a lot of hot air, and they pay lip service to the Palestinian cause but don't do anything about it?
Many of the Arab regimes get their legitimacy not from their populations. They were not voted into their presidencies or their offices, but they have their legitimacy come from superpowers like the United States and other big countries. So they will function in the interest of those who gave them their legitimacy, of those who give them their protection. So if I get my protection from the United States, I will do what the United States wants me to do. If I get my legitimacy from my people, I will work for the good of my people. Unfortunately, the Arabs are also going through problems. The Arab people have been trying to get back their rights in getting the kind of governments that will represent them, and they are working on it. We saw the Arab Spring. The people were trying to get their voices heard. But it's going to take some time, you know. The counter forces are too strong at this point.
Talk about the country you live in right now, Jordan. It's kind of an old land, but a new country. How was it formed?
Jordan has two stories of how it was founded. There is the view that Jordan was founded as a triumph of the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire and the Turks. Towards the beginning of the 20th century, the Ottoman Empire, which ruled over all of the Arab world, was getting weakened, and it was, you know, it hardly had enough resources to sustain its forces outside of Turkey. So the Arabs wanted their independence, and the Arab revolt that created the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan was considered, to the Hashemites that are ruling Jordan now, it was the founding of Jordan was the end triumph of the Arab revolt. Now the other view is that Jordan was founded as a byproduct of the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when Balfour, the foreign secretary of England, gave the letter to Lord Rothschild that we promise you Palestine as a Jewish homeland. The area that is east of the Jordan River, which was called Transjordan, which is today's Jordan, was considered part of the Balfour Declaration. And then when the Hashemites worked with the British to get out the Turks from this area, and by the end of the First World War, the Ottoman Empire was finished, the British felt that they needed to reward the Hashemites for their support in getting the Ottomans out, and they promised east of the Jordan River to the Hashemites. So it is either seen as a triumph of the Arabs against the Turks, or it is seen as a byproduct of the big Zionist project that was manifested by the Balfour Declaration.
But didn't the British and the French basically double-cross the Arabs? They were promising them if they joined the revolt against the Ottoman Turks that they would have independent states when the war ended.
They were promising everybody everything. They promised the Saud family, the whole of Najd and Hijaz, which is today Saudi Arabia. They promised the Hashemites part of Hijaz, which is today's Mecca, and Transjordan, Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon. They promised the Jews Palestine. And then the First World War ended. So the British decided to divide the area that we call the Levant, which today make up Palestine / Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, in the agreement of Sykes-Picot. They divided it so that Jordan and Palestine would go to the British, Syria and Lebanon would go to the French. They promised the Hashemites Jordan and Palestine, but they also promised the Jews Palestine. So there was double crossing. At the end of the day, the Jews got Palestine and the Hashemites got the area that's east of the Jordan River.
So the monarchy is established here in Amman, and it continues now. What is the structure of political power in the country? Is the monarch a figurehead, or does he wield actual power?
The monarch has absolute power here. We have a parliament, and it's elected, but the parliament can be dissolved by the king. The head of the government is not elected. The prime minister and the ministers are all appointed by the king. The head of the army is appointed by the king. And I think the head of intelligence is also appointed by the king. So the monarch really runs the show in Jordan.
And what about economic power?
Jordan is a small country, and it's, you know, surrounded by problems everywhere. To the west, we have the Palestine-Israeli problem. To the north, we have the Syrian problem. To the east, we have Iraq. To the south, we have Saudi Arabia and its problems with Yemen. So Jordan has maintained its stability. The monarch here, the king here, has been very careful not to step on anyone and not to let anybody step on him. So the country has kept its stability, but at the same time, because of its position between warring countries everywhere, trade has been difficult. Expansion, in trade agreements has been difficult. Progress has been difficult. So Jordan, doesn't have a very bright future economically.
But I've heard in terms of divisions of labor, if you will, that the political power goes mostly to the Jordanians, for want of a better term, and economic power lies mostly with the Palestinians who have been living in this country for many years.
Since the establishment of the State of Israel, the Jewish terrorist gangs like Stern and Haganah and so on were very effective in creating the refugee problem of the Palestinians. And the Palestinians, because of the military power of these gangsters and, you know, these terrorist gangs, the Jewish gangs at the time, had to flee. So hundreds of thousands of Palestinians went to Jordan. Some went up to Lebanon and Syria, and some went to Egypt. So Jordan, which was, typically an empty land with a few cities and some big tribes, some Bedouin tribes, now had hundreds of thousands of Palestinians come and stay as refugees. These Palestinians had to, you know, build themselves into communities, had to start trade, and so on. And then 19 years after that, 1967, another war, the occupation of the West Bank, drove more Palestinians towards Jordan. So now Palestinians, Jordanians of Palestinian origin, I might say, because most of them got Jordanian citizenship, but Jordanians of Palestinian origin constitute something around 60% of the country.
King Abdullah, the grandfather of the current king, whose name is also Abdullah, in 1950, annexes the West Bank, and he is assassinated by Palestinian nationalists the next year in 1951. What happened there?
The Palestinians were not happy with the way the Arab leadership dealt with the Palestinian problem. You know, there were deals between some Arab leaders and the Jewish agency before the establishment of Israel. The Arabs did not put in their power to try to, you know, to help the Palestinians get back their country. And King Abdullah was seen by some Palestinians as somebody who had betrayed their cause. So somebody assassinated him when he was praying in the Aqsa Mosque.
And he was succeeded by his son, Talal, who very quickly left office, and succeeded by his grandson, Abdullah's grandson, King Hussein, who at that time was a teenager. And he is the one, you know, often called the plucky little king. He died in 1999. He's kind of been the face of Jordan that a lot of people outside this region recognize.
Yes. When King Abdullah was assassinated, his son Talal took office. Talal was a nationalist. During his brief 2 years as king, they drew up the Jordanian constitution of 1952. It was a very nice constitution. It gave powers to the parliament, and the parliament could appoint governments. And, you know, it was a very good constitution that, you know, clearly divided powers in the country in a way that will sustain it efficiently. But then after 2 years, he was seen incapable of rule.
Seen by whom?
He was seen by apparently the doctor of the family, by his wife, by the people close to him, that he was incapable of continuing his rule. So his son Hussein became king, but his son was still young. So his uncle, his mother's brother, was sort of a trustee until Hussein reached the proper age for kingship.
And King Hussein dies in 1999. He's succeeded by his son, King Abdullah, who rules today. What are his politics like?
King Abdullah believes in neoliberal ideas. He believes that the government's hand should take a rest and the free hand of the market should work. He believes in privatization of the economy. He worked on doing some of these things. Jordan owes the World Bank. Jordan, you know, has debt to the World Bank. And the World Bank has its conditions. Sometimes it's not that the king wants to maybe privatize, or not the king that wants to sell the resources. It is the World Bank's conditions sometimes that force the country to do certain things to keep it on its good side. When the king took control in 1999, he saw that the country was in debt. The World Bank advised that maybe, you know, you should sell your resources to create cash flow. You should reduce your government spending. So government spending was reduced. And then there was a lot of deregulation so that you can attract investors to come and buy the government, you know, agencies or government companies that were being privatized.
I've seen flyers and posters around Jordan saying no to the gas deal. What's that about?
Jordan historically has been buying natural gas from Egypt. And then when Egypt from 2011 started going through its turmoil of the Arab Spring and afterwards, there were some sabotaging of the pipes. So Jordan would have erratic supply of natural gas. Now, the alternatives were many. We can get the gas from the world market. We can get the gas from Qatar. We can get the gas from Algeria. We can get the gas from any other country. But unfortunately, Jordan signed an agreement with Israel, which found gas on the Mediterranean outside of the shores. It made an agreement with Israel so that Israel would supply Jordan with gas for 15 years. And we see this as capitulation to a country that is occupying the land of Palestine. We see this as an extension of the occupation of Palestine. This is the kind of neo-occupation where they don't come here with their forces and military, but they come here to control the economy.
You're the president of an environmental organization here in Jordan. Wasn't there any move towards sustainable energy, such as all the sunshine you have here, something like 300 days a year of sun and all the wind power that exists?
You know, Jordan has plenty of area to put the solar panels. Jordan also has a grid that is not very efficient, and just, you know, fixing the grid would save something around 35% of the electricity. And we have different sources of natural gas we can get from other countries. We have a lot of shale oil that we can extract if we wanted to. We have wind power. But unfortunately, Jordan has decided to buy the natural gas from Israel. Now, we are working on some, you know, in the country, on some solar energy programs and projects, but they haven't materialized fully yet. And we hope that once they do, we won't be in need of, you know, working with Israel.
And what about, for example, alternative transportation to get some of the notorious traffic jams in Amman at least diminished? What about recycling? Are there any kind of state programs on those areas? In general, what is the environmental eco-consciousness here in Jordan?
Unfortunately, we are very slow on these projects. The Jordanians are hardly coping with the very fast increase in population. In 2003, I'll go back to 1990, the first American invasion of Iraq, about 400,000 to 500,000 Jordanians that worked in Kuwait came back to Jordan, created a big, big change in the demographics. 13 years after that, the American invasion of Iraq again, destroyed Iraq, hundreds of thousands, and, you know, some estimates would take that up to a million Iraqis came to Jordan. So Jordan has been having one influx after the other, and now after 2011, you have so many Syrians in Jordan. Jordan is hardly coping with this fast growth in population. You have problems in water supply, you have problems in traffic, and, not much is actually being done to deal with all of this because of monetary hardships. You know, Jordan is a country that's in debt. It's trying to do things here and there, but it's not enough.
Why did the king decide to deploy the Jordanian Air Force in Syria?
You know, Jordan, like I said, has been very, very careful not to step on anyone. And, you know, Jordan is the neighbor to the richest Arab country, which is Saudi Arabia. And in so many instances, when Jordan was in dire monetary situation, Saudi Arabia stepped in to help Jordan. And, with the problems in Syria, Saudi Arabia was worried that if the problems get closer to Jordan, if the radical groups like ISIS and so on would get to the borders of Jordan, maybe they could start problems in Jordan, and Jordan is at the doorsteps of Saudi Arabia. So there was a lot of pressure on Jordan to join the countries that are fighting ISIS in Syria. Jordan is also considered an American ally. Jordan tries to go on American lines to accept the American, you know, the American strategies for this region, and there was pressure also from the United States to join the alliance against ISIS in Syria. So Jordanian planes were sent to fight ISIS.
And in conversations I've had since I've been in Jordan for about a week, a lot of people ask me, who is Daesh? Who is the Islamic State? Who are these people? Where do they come from? How do they get their funding? Do you have any insight into their origins?
I'm telling you, if anybody tells you they know who Daesh is or who ISIS is or where their funding comes from, I think they're lying. They have so many cars, they have so many people, they have so many weapons. You just don't know how it started. You know, they came out of nowhere, all of a sudden occupying the city of Mosul and Iraq, declaring, you know, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq. They become so powerful all of a sudden. Nobody understands what ISIS is.
And King Abdullah was in Washington meeting with Trump. He made a number of very supportive comments about the United States. And Trump, he said, is beginning to bring Palestinians and Israelis together. Is Trump doing that? Am I missing something here?
I think the king goes to the superpower of the world. He is going to say something positive about the president. And I don't think it goes any further than that.
And what is your reaction to the appointment of David Friedman, who was Trump's personal bankruptcy lawyer and a supporter of the Bet El settlement in the occupied West Bank?
There is nothing new here. You know, the United States has been an unconditional supporter of Israel. Like one Israeli journalist and writer once said, if the Jewish lobby in the United States wants to cancel the Ten Commandments from the Bible, they will get so with an overwhelming majority in the U.S. Senate. It doesn't make any difference to us anymore who is in office in the United States, who is the ambassador in Israel, who is the ambassador in Jordan or Saudi Arabia. To us, the United States is going to be on the side of Israel. They are not honest brokers when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to the Palestinian conflict. To the contrary, they keep fighting the Palestinians not to get their rights. They keep supporting Israel despite Israel's abuses of international law, despite Israel's attacks against the Palestinians, against the Lebanese, despite Israeli checkpoints, uprooting of millions of trees, the robbing of Palestinian water, you know, the continuous occupation, the building of the wall. None of these instances did we see the United States step up to its moral responsibility to stop the funding of these atrocious acts.
So what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is that, you know, things are changing with social media. Things are changing in the West. And, you know, those who are liberal are fighting for morals and fighting for, you know, universal principles like human rights and freedom of expression and so on. And we see so many people in the West looking at the Palestinian problem as a contradiction, you know, contradiction with what they believe in, and especially Jews. They're still marginal, but they are coming out and they are saying, you know, we don't approve of what the state of Israel is doing in the name of the Jewish people. We are not like that. Our religion doesn't teach us to treat others like that. This is completely something that is unacceptable by us. And they are, you know, they're dissociating themselves from the state of Israel and their Zionist ideologies.
And what is the background of your activism? How did you get engaged?
You know, living in this part of the world, you see the effects of American policy every day. You see the effects of the wars every day. And when the second Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, broke out, we were seeing that 40 miles from here, people were being, you know, treated like animals every day. In a small area like the West Bank, you had over 500 checkpoints. Palestinians could not move from one village to the other without being interrogated, without being questioned, without being harassed. Women were having their children on the checkpoints because the Israelis would not allow them to go to the hospitals. Let me tell you, the occupation, it is by default a military occupation, is so violent, it is so oppressive, it is so unhuman right-like. And, you know, when you live so close to this, you need to do something about it. You need to alleviate the problems of your, you know, of your Palestinian neighbors.
You were just listening to Rami Barhoush on Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and the United States. I talked with him in Amman, Jordan. Rami Barhoush is an activist and president of the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, based in Amman. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Nancy McLean, Noam Chomsky, Max Blumenthal, Michael Parenti, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. We have a number of programs on the Middle East. To access our complete audio and book catalog, and by the way, my new book with Noam Chomsky has just come out, and we have copies. It's called Global Discontents. Just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.